What's up, everybody? Not My House is in the house. Is your host, Eric. And as always, right next to me is my co-host, Zach. Zach, what's going on this morning, my friend?
Excited today. For the first time, we got an official on the podcast. And this is going to be a really fun one. I can't wait to get to this.
He played college basketball at Rhode Island College, where he was a 1,000-point scorer. He has officiated every level, including the NCAA and the NBA. He's a co-founder of True Bounce Backboard, which is a really cool product we're looking forward to talking to him more about. I'm honored to have him on the show today, Mr. Eric Brito. How are you doing today, sir?
Oh, I'm blessed, man. Thanks, guys, for the opportunity to talk with you guys. I've heard a lot about your program, and I'm always interested in collaborating some basketball information amongst the basketball family, and also share my invention of the True Bounce Backboard, which is taken off throughout the basketball industry.
Yeah, and we can't wait to hear all about that. And, you know, before we start, you know, you're a good friend of the con man, Michael Consacio. He's been a good friend of ours and a huge supporter of our show. And, you know, just give our listeners a quick rundown of how the two of you got linked up. Like, how far back do you guys go?
Oh, we go back probably sophomore year in high school. He's a little older than I am. We kind of hooked up at the playgrounds. And that's really not familiar with the kids today. The kids don't go to the playgrounds to play as much as we did. Oh, am I showing my age, Zach? I don't know. I'm showing my age.
No, we all played. We definitely played in the parks and stuff like that. So we understand the blacktop game very well. So you're not dating yourself, my friend.
All right. And that's where we really kind of bonded with each other on the blacktop, 2-on-2s, 3-on-3s, full court, and then hanging out and going to have a beer and chasing girls on Friday night was really the.
There you go.
Connected us. And then we became a family. Mike Conn, we call ourselves the Steel Brothers. There's about four other fellas that are kind of tight knit in the community that we grew up and went to college and supported each other. And then as we got adults, we became family members. And here we are still loving each other.
Well, you got that East Coast accent I'm picking up. I'm a Jersey guy. So why don't you let the listeners know where you did grow up? And what was your childhood was like growing up there playing sports?
Yeah, we claim we're the fish capital of the world, New Bedford, Mass. It's a little south of Boston, the gateway to the Cape Cod area, live on the water. And we kind of love hanging out at the beaches and playing blacktop close to the water. We started playing blacktop basketball in April and probably ended in October. That's how much we fell in love with the game. And we trickled up to Boston area to play ball, Providence, New York. My dad was a huge tournament and community guy and put all the players together and brought the teams down and took trips with us. So we had a good round of experience in different levels of basketball. We had some good talent that came out of our little small town. We had a big summer league back in the day, and my father used to run tournaments, and that's how I got into refereeing. I actually wanted to be a coach because I was a point guard by trade and a quarterback, but he said, nah, go referee, and he didn't have any guys refereeing the tournament game, so he handed me the ball. He said, yeah, I need you to ref, and from there, I just kind of got good at it and kind of went to the next level with it. However, I still love coaching, and I still coach young kids, and I coach referees too. So it's just in my blood of coaching. Actually, my focus is to help make the game better. That's kind of my mission in life. God has given me the ability to see the court and see what should be better so the kids can have more fun.
Yeah. And, you know, I coach high school girls. So coach to coach, I appreciate everything that you're doing. You know, we're just trying to pass on, you know, knowledge and, you know, show them life lessons both on and off the course. I do appreciate you for that for sure. But, you know, you mentioned New Bedford area, a lot of great players coming out of that area for sure. Who were some of your idols growing up as a kid? Like, who did you want to play like, chew gum like, act like, and give our listeners an idea of what kind of player you were. I think it's always interesting for our listeners to know of what kind of player you were and who you like to.
Yes. My favorite player was Clyde Frazier. I had number 10. Yeah, I loved the way he played, Clyde Frazier. And, of course, you had the big all-time greats was the Larry Birds of the world and Magic Johnson, how they shared the ball and saw the floor. I'm probably telling you how I played already if I like those type of players. Kareem, I used to like to give the ball to the post players that were open. As soon as they were open, give them the ball and take it to them, like take it to them. So fundamentally sound. I didn't have a lot of natural ability to as a what they call it as a blue chipper. So I studied the game and I had a good IQ for the game, and I developed that part of it. Got everybody involved. Knew what position they played and got the ball to them at the right spot. My coach in college was Jim Adams, who used to coach Marvin Bonds, who was the assistant at Providence for years. He went to Rhode Island College, and I was his first recruit. And he taught me a lot. He was a great practice coach and taught me how to add to my game, knowing who to give the ball to at the right spot. He was really good at that. And I had fun. I scored 4 years in college and scored 1,000 points. And I played when there was no three-pointer.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we played three-pointers. So we scored some points on the mid-range area, 17, 15 feet in. But my love for basketball kind of expounded into the equipment area, where I got an idea to invent a new basketball backboard. We call it True Bounce. Up in the East Coast here, you had the metal backboards that were perforated. I don't know if you're familiar with them. Eric might know.
You might have
seen them in New Jersey.
Yeah.
All up and down the – yeah. So I took that concept and made it professional and put some holes in it. And the physics of it is it takes some of the energy off the ball and drops it closer to the basket, a better feel for you shooting at the backboard, similar to the breakaway rim. If you're familiar with the players, made the breakaway rim really popular. It was put in for the safety of the game, but the players made it popular because it took some steam off the ball, some energy. It was able to go hard and finish.
You know, I checked out the website and I was looking at the diagrams. And how did you figure out the physics of that? Was it just something of just playing? Because, you know, you talk also about, like, you know, helping with the mid-range shot, but then also helping, like, rewarding people boxing out, which I thought was cool, you know, because boxing out, I think, is a lost art nowadays. How does the physics part come about of creating this product?
Well, I know it's kind of an engineer by trade who kind of runs the day-to-day in the factory. We actually make the backboards right in New Bedford. So I'm the basketball mind and he's the product mind behind it. So the holes that the metal backboards was for the wind. So the system wouldn't eventually kind of get toppled over in time. But the ball also has wind. So when the ball hits the backboard, some of that energy goes through it. So what we did is we kind of made the holes a little smaller and spaced them a little bit for the bounce to be acceptable in the basketball realm of playing, because you need a bounce. The ball has to come off. Eric, if you know, you rebound in the rebounding zone, so the ball couldn't die before that because it would have never made it. So we kind of strategically placed the holes, made them a little smaller so that so much air wouldn't go out of it, so it wouldn't die. Like drop at the side of the rim, we needed some bounce, and that's how we tried like different size holes. And when I found being a referee and knowing basketball, I knew where the ball had to bounce, so we wouldn't have to change the whole dynamics of people studying or playing basketball, the basic rules of it, or the fundamentals of it. And that half inch hole kind of made the basketball bounce right in the rebound zone. And then I was like, oh, I think I got something.
Now let me ask you, I'm assuming it's good for indoors and outdoors. And if it is, is it more preferable for outdoor play or for indoor play, or does it really matter?
Doesn't matter. We focused on the preferable, the success of the play and the bounce. If you notice, if you watch games now, Eric, mm-hmm. players miss layups when they drive to the basket
a lot
because the solid surface whether it's a steel backboard or a glass backboard inside, it doesn't equate to the physics of basketball. So they're going hard and they're throwing it hard. It's coming off hard, and they have to adjust in midstream, and it's impossible. So they either hit the back of the rim, or they miss the front of the rim, or they're off to the right or the left because they don't really know where to go, and they kind of like loft it up. I mean, I'm doing some stats now. The pros, anywhere's from 9 feet to 0 feet in as a layup, they shoot 50%
Wow.
in the NBA. And the overall percentage is 45% field goal percentage. So now these guys are getting $100 million a year, shoot 50% from 0 to 9 feet.
It's the
It's
three
not their ability.
it's a 3-point game nowadays, man. That's why you're seeing those percentages go down. All the kids just practice 3-pointers instead of learning the whole game, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's really, if you look at it, it's the equipment that we're taught to use, because you have to, if y'all going fast, that ball's going. So Dr. Naismith back in 1891 said, hey, use this box right here and it'll help you score. But it doesn't work right now. So what we invented, something that's similar to the breakaway rim, it's a little give, and now will reward you for your ability to be creative and use the backboard. If you really look at it, the ball is, if you play with a hard ball, you throw it away. The ball's got to be kind of soft, right? The wood
Yeah.
floor is forgiving. The breakaway rim is now forgiving. So the only other component in this realm is the backboard. And I'm telling the corporate people that it doesn't make sense. You got a hard surface and you got three other soft surfaces. It doesn't equal success.
Right. Well, and it makes sense to me too, because there hasn't been that much that's changed from the backboard for the most part, but what you guys are presenting seems just to make sense. You know what I mean? In terms of a change, it makes complete sense. How successful have you guys been for getting this product into gyms?
Oh, well, we're 20 years in the business. And if you
Nice.
know basketball, right?
Yeah, of course.
If we would have been out of business in 2 years if the players didn't like it,
Yeah.
right? I can't even make that up. If you got a ball that you bounce one time and it goes the other way, you're like, yeah, give me another ball.
Right.
So we're in the high school level, we're in the prep school level, we're in the semi-pro summer league levels outside. We have indoors. We have major schools in the Washington, D.C. area. Whole counties changing them out. I'm still knocking on the corporate doors, which is the NCAA and the NBA. I mean, we shoot one of our prep schools in Worcester Academy, which they won the state championship last year. I mean, the regional championship. They shoot 33% less 3-pointers and win games.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
Now, when you
So we
have,
have that.
let me ask you this question because I'm curious. When you have it, like, in certain gyms, right? I almost feel like it's a home court advantage to the school that has it in their gym, which makes it almost like, here's a selling point. Obviously, you probably already know. It's like, this is why it should be available. Citywide, statewide, all the way up to the biggest level, because it really gives that gym a home court advantage if the other team hasn't played on it, correct?
Yeah, there's two parts to that. There's two parts. There's two answers to that question. Okay. So, yeah, we do look for a home court advantage, and I never really sold it that way, but yeah, it is. However, every team is taught to use the backboard.
Right.
So, if you do what you're fun be taught, it becomes an advantage for you. So I interviewed, I was sitting down with a Division I coach, LSU coach, 1 year. I was presenting a backboard at a big AAU tournament in Las Vegas. And we had them up, and the kids were playing on them, and we were doing some research. So I I posed a question to him. And he says, "Oh yeah, that's interesting." He said, "Wow, though, what would happen if I played at Kentucky and they didn't have him and I had him?" And I didn't say anything for a couple of seconds. And then he answered his own question. He said, "Oh shoot, Division I teams lose 90% of the times on the road anyway. So, in other words, it didn't make a difference. I'm gonna be better at home if I can win at home more times than often. Then I'm losing on the road anyway." Now I was like, "Wow, that was an interesting comment." I didn't even really kind of push him to it. So it's supposed to be a home court advantage. You're supposed to play with your own ball in your own court, right? The home team gets to pick the ball. Their net, their rim is where it is. Their lights are what they are. Their crowd is what it is. So, I mean, the big guys are kind of telling me, using that as an excuse not to implement true bounce as of right now. But the way the game is going, the mid-range and the post-play, I mean, I don't know if you saw the article or the video that Milwaukee's now kind of adjusting and not helping as much. Milwaukee Bucks, they're saying, "We got to find somebody to defend this three-pointer." And they're hanging out at the corners now and making it more difficult, making it more defensive-minded to bother the three-point attempts, yeah, and let them drive. Because they're shooting 50% on the drive, which I'm calculating myself, is why not? See, the coaches right now are gonna kind of the coaches that promote it are gonna now kind of try to stop it. It's the same people, because it's gone too far. It's too massive. They gotta now adjust to it. And then what's gonna happen? They're gonna drive to the basket and success, because of the equipment from 100 years has never been upgraded or moved with the times. Hopefully that's a positive for True Bounce getting to the next level.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can just hear, just from the way that you talk, that you got a lot of knowledge about the game, and obviously what you've created at True Bounce is incredible. And you know, I really want to jump into your officiating and kind of pick your brain on that. But first, how did you really get into officiating, and did you know that's what you wanted to do when you were done playing, or you know, what really got you into officiating?
Oh, well, to answer the first question, I wanted to coach, Zach. Like, you know, I wanted to be my high school. That was my dream, coach my high school. I was the leader to the States. I knew basketball. How I got into officiating is my dad was an official and a coach. But at the time was that the officials were starting to make some money and it was getting popular. And my dad said, "Hey, I'm going to send you a referee to referee camp. Go and referee. You can make a lot of money. We have a lot of games. My father did a lot of shootouts, local shootouts. He's a legend in this area." And I was like, all right. And so I began to referee in the neighborhood, in the playgrounds. And because of my basketball knowledge and IQ, I picked up on it really fast. I refereed as a player, as a knowledgeable player. So I picked up really quick the technique and the mannerisms and just how to run the game. And I'm a people person. I like to distribute the ball. I have two companies. People love to work for me. So I could really kind of gather the game and make everybody fair and go through the game properly. So I kind of got good at it. And then I went to the high school level. And I went to the semi-pro level, went to the college level, and I just 32 years later, 35 years later, I'm doing some prep school games now, and helping the young guys learn how to referee as professionals. Yeah, but you can ask me some good referee questions, Dak, and I'm chomping at the bit. So give them to me. What do you want to know?
Yeah, well, the one I'm really wanting to know about is, because, as you know, because you went and played from high school to college as a player, so, and you have to make adjustments as a player. So I want to know, as an official, when you're officiating, you know, high school youth games, but then you go on to like the college and pro levels, like what was the biggest adjustment for you as an official? Like once you got to that next level, like what did you notice as official that was your biggest adjustment?
Oh, it was more serious. It was a job, more of a job. It was more of a mind game. Okay, at the lower levels, you call the plays for the players. At the college level, they, and I'll go back to my coach, Coach Adams, James Adams, when I was pursuing the professional level, I told him about it. And the first thing he said is, yeah, watch out. They're going to go after your mind. They're going to beat your mind up. Because at the pro level, Zach, everybody's got the same talent. So how do you gain an advantage? You get in somebody's head. You know, like in the black, Eric, like in the blacktop, right? We used to get in each other's head. Ask Michael Kahn, I used to get in his head all the time and win the 2-on-2. You get frustrated. So at the professional level, at the highest level, it's about the mind. Once you're there, your ability's there. Now, can you concentrate for 40 minutes, 48 minutes? Can you ward off them trying to influence you to cheat for them? Can you keep it fair when you make a mistake? Not make it up, but can you not miss one and keep the game fair and let the coaches know that you're not cheating for the other guy? Because that's the first thing they're looking for. Because they can't beat you ability-wise because they're pros. Everybody can beat anybody in any given day at the pro level.
I was going to say, I coach high school basketball, as I said earlier, and I know very well how much officials go through dealing with coaches, players, fans, parents, and I know it can take a big mental hit. And he kind of talked about, you know, the mental aspect of it. So talk to us about the pressures of officiating, and was it hard for you mentally to officiate games, especially once you got to that higher level, or was there maybe a level that was more difficult than the other from a mental standpoint for you?
Yeah, no, it's challenging because how they treat you to influence you, you think it's personal. So you got to kind of ward that off. It's not personal. They don't even care about you. They just want to win. So like I did a prep school game at Tabor Academy. It's down in Marion, down here on the towards the Cape Cod. Good school. And I anticipated. And I'm an experienced referee. I don't really miss too many calls because I know what I'm doing and I'm pretty confident. But I anticipated a backside foul from the trail. And the defender missed his arm and he got the ball. And my whistle was coming and I blew the whistle. As soon as I blew it, Zach, I said, I want to. I was trying to chase that air and get it back in my whistle. And it was gone. And it was as soon as that's a back, this, that, oh, no. That's, so I went. And I called, I went to the coach. I stood next to him. I said, listen, I'm going to let you know I missed that play. It was a bad call. And he looked at me. He's like, wow, thank you very much. And then the player came over to me when I was on the court. And he said, hey, you. I said, my man, I'm going to let you know. So I missed that call. I anticipated it. I just want to let you know that wasn't a good call. And I didn't hear a word after that. And that's a challenge because referees don't want to say that.
Right. Yeah. And
so now they got a home run.
Yeah, and those are the officials that I really, really appreciate. Just the ones that you can talk to and the ones that can admit when they miss a call. So I have a lot of respect for officials that can do that. And I just have respect for officials in general. And I know the job is impossible to please everyone. And I know many high school officials around town, you know, because I coach. And, you know, sometimes they can be very critical of other refs that they work with. And I'm curious if you were ever matched up with a certain official that might call a game different for you. And if so, is it difficult to do your job when you're matched up with guys like that? I mean, do you guys talk about before the game how you want to call it before games, or do you just have to adjust on the fly? What can you tell us about that? Because sometimes, especially at the lower levels, you can really see some of the inconsistencies with one official compared to his partners. I'm curious if you guys have conversations about that.
That's very difficult. And the difficult part of amateur basketball is the referees don't get training. They read the book and they see some things on TV and they look at the mechanics, but they don't get training. Like I used to have to stop doing high school ball when I started to enter the CBA and the NBA program because I was way beyond guys calling and I was the focus. Everybody was looking at me because my whistle was so quick and fast and I was calling things that maybe no one else called. You have to blend in. So it's very difficult to come from the high levels to referee in the amateur levels. That's one. When your partner is either not that good or calling a totally different game, it's very difficult. You can't talk about that. You got it because he may be thinking that this is what I see and what I call how I was taught. And now the game's a mess, Zach. It's a mess. It's like I was telling my referee Saturday, I was like, this, and there's a professional ref. That's it. And then either you're an amateur or you're a professional, and it's totally two different. And now you got the whole circuit of this AAU phenomenon, where now refs are not amateurs and they're not professionals. They just ref for money. They just call, oh, that's not fair, foul, and they have no allegiance. They have no dedication. They have no feel for the game. They don't love the game. It's just like the AAU program. They're just taking money from folks. And I'm not slamming the program, but I'm just giving you some facts because it is what it is. And where we came from, it's either you're playing ball because you love it or you're playing ball because you're a professional and you're getting paid for it. There was really no other reason you play basketball. And today there's that in between where they, oh, I hope I can go to North Carolina. Let me go and do some A. Let me play AAU basketball, and I'll get seen by a coach. So, but to answer your question, yeah, it's when two referees are not on the same page, it's very challenging. Either if you have two real bad referees, it's easier to, Zach, in the high school level, to overcome than having one good referee. Bad referee. Your game, how come you didn't call that? And then you're yelling at me way down here, Eric, you didn't see that? And then Zach, how can I go in that guy, get the same pay as me? How can I go in there and get his pay and call everything in front of his face? I can't do that. I'm watching over here. So there's a lot of different answers to that question.
You know, I want to know, how do you really work your way up into the NBA ranks as an official? Like, can you just talk about your journey to the NBA and, you know, the classes and the training that you had to go through to get there?
Yes. I my story is different than other people. Every ref has a different story or a different journey, call it. Mine was through the Pro-Am system in New York City, where I used to go to classes once a month. I used to go down on Saturdays to do Pro-Am games, ex-pros like Gus Williams and Ray Williams and them guys. I used to live in New York that played. They played in the Pro-Am. We used to train in their games. So you really got some good play and understanding of how the professionals really play the game. And then you would go to the national Pro-Am tournaments, and then the pro scouts would come and watch the young referees. And then they would evaluate you, and if they liked you, they'd put you in the CBA, which was different than the G League. And this was all two-man games, no, not three referees. This was all two-man. So we would learn and train and work in the CBA and do the playoffs. And then we'd go to, in the summer, we'd go to the NBA camps where the NBA summer leagues were played. And then you get evaluated, and hopefully you would get chosen to go to maybe do some exhibition games in the NBA. And then and go back to the CBA, and they'd watch you and evaluate you and develop you. Some guys go from college. They get seen on TV, Final Four, the NBA plucks them and go to camp, and they like them in their pro camp, and then they give them a contract. Some may go just to a regular camp, and there might be an NBA official who's working the camp, and he may recommend you to the guys that hire. And then you go that route, and then – you could go to the NBA in 2 years. You could take 10 years. You can go to the NCAA Final Four in 2 years. It could take 20 years. So there's real no set way. Back when I was coming up, there's conflicts between the powers that be, and they don't want to hire somebody from New York because they're mad at the guy that leads New York, that trains the guys in New York. It's a political play, as you know, in at the high level. They may have too many guys from Philly, and this year they're going to hire guys from Phoenix. So you never really knew rhyme or reason. Everybody was good. Everybody could have made it. I mean, when we were coming up, there was only two spots a year. There was an easy 20 guys that could make the roster. There was only two spots.
Yeah, that's not a lot of
So,
spots either. It's hard enough to make the NBA as a player, and it sounds like as official, that's even a smaller window.
it's a small window. Yeah. And then now people may like the way your hair is, your color, your skin, the size of your biceps, the way you run, different bosses. And then now they have women now that's competing on the men level. So there are a lot of different equations to the answer. I was one of the top rated young officials in the minor leagues and didn't get hired full time. And no one today, if you ask the guys that were coming up with me, they don't know the reason why I didn't get hired. So,
Yeah.
but you know what? I invented the best basketball backcourt in the world from it. So I'll thank them for that.
Yeah, it all worked out in the end, right? I mean, your journey definitely led to an awesome place at the backboard and everything. And, all of our former guests have really been former NBA players. And I always ask them what their welcome to the league moment was. And this will be an interesting one for you because you're our first official. So I want to know what your welcome to the league moment was as an official. Like, was there a maybe a coach or a player that maybe tried to embarrass you, or somebody that just kind of starstruck you, or somebody that really taught you something in your, first NBA debut? Like, what was your welcome to the league moment for you?
Yeah, I tell the story all the time. I was doing the Lakers and Indiana Pacers. And at the time, Larry Brown was coach, legendary Larry Brown. And Reggie Miller got fouled and there was no call. And there was no call on his foul. And then I came down the floor and I called a foul on Reggie Miller. And he kind of didn't like it and gave me a few body shots and head shots. And I can't remember if we called a tech on him or not. But anyway, so I'm standing next to Larry Brown and he walks up to me all calm and collected. He says, Eric, if you got the first foul, you wouldn't have had to deal with the second foul like that. And I was like, wow, welcome to the NBA. And I was like, thank you much for that. And that was just like a lot, and he wasn't mad at me. It was like a teaching moment. I'll never forget that as long as I live. He just got up I saw him get off the bench, walked over, had his hands in his pockets. He said, "If you got the first foul, you wouldn't have had to deal with this right now." And I was like, "Wow!" And I knew we missed the foul
Yeah.
because the plays in the NBA happen like four times faster than you watch it on TV. The referees make it look real easy, but it's like so fast,
Oh yeah.
so quick.
Yeah, the speed of the game at every level as you
And
go up
I
gets
was like,
faster.
from that day on, Zach, too many first fouls, Zach.
I'm sure. And you bring up Reggie Miller, and he's got to be such a difficult player to officiate. Are there certain players that are more difficult to officiate for you? I mean, who is the most difficult player for you to officiate? I mean, because there's Shaq, who's just so big, and there's guys like Paul Pierce, who are known for, using their body very cleverly, or maybe Vlade Divac for flopping. Like, who is the hardest player for you to officiate, or what type of player is the hardest one?
You know who was very difficult was Oakley. Charles Oakley was tough to referee.
Interesting.
Yeah, he was a beast, man. And he wasn't nice. He was tough. Dennis Rodman was tough. Laimbeer was tough. Those guys that kind of was smart and they knew how they were strong and they just knew how to use their bodies and kind of flick people where it looked like a foul, but it really wasn't. The little stuff. But the speedy guards were tough. The toughest guys, although I have to say to you, the toughest guys was in the basketball capital of the world to referee was New York City in the Pro-Am. In the summertime when all the pros came and the city players came around, those guys were so smart and savvy and they knew the game. And that's where you cut your teeth and learn how to referee. You can referee in a pro in New York City, you can referee anywhere.
Is it, do you ref it differently in the Pro-Am, the summer leagues? Like, is it a little looser?
Well, it's a fine line, Eric. I can't. It's like a fine line. You can't referee by the book because they'll throw the book at you. You can't call everything because they'll run you out the gym. And you got to call something that if they get hit and they miss a shot, they'll run you out the gym if you miss the call.
Right.
So it's like if you watch a game at Madison Square Garden, everybody in New York City IQ is 100 about basketball. It's just that's the way it's capital of the world. It's everybody does what they do. They just from high school to the high school is the pros and the pros are pros. It's so important and so serious. So you it's a fine line. You can't I tell young guys if you're refereeing by the book, you're not gonna last long.
Yeah, well, it makes sense because the flow of the game changes too if you're doing that. You know, I mean, where's the flow of the game if you're going by the book and you can call so much. I mean, like, in NFL football, you can call a hold on every play. You know, it would kill the speed the speed of the game. If that makes sense. Obviously, it makes sense.
Exactly. If it's way over there, yeah, if it's on the other side of the field, you're gonna call holding if the play's way over there, or if the player couldn't catch the ball. I mean, all right,
Yeah, it's
keep
on the
it going.
fly. It's on the
Yeah,
fly
you're right. Yeah.
decisions for you guys, which I think a lot of fans don't realize. You know, like you said, the speed of the game. I definitely understand that because you can definitely see how the speed goes from level to level to level up. But I don't think a lot of people understand the speed of the game in terms of reffing the game. And I'm glad you brought that point up today for the listeners, especially the younger listeners. You know, showing more respect to referees, realizing like split second calls. You know, you could do it on your couch after you see the replay three or four times, but you don't have that opportunity to see the replay three or four times. So it's, I think, if people learn a lot from this episode, the biggest thing they should learn from is that, you got to give the refs a little more slack. It's not easy to make calls, especially that fast. Question I want to ask you, do you watch film or, when you were reffing at that level, did you watch a lot of film or no? Like on yourself, like watching the game and how would I call
Every
that
day,
differently every day?
all the time.
Makes total sense. Makes total sense. Did you watch other referees? Like, did you have referees that you admired and go, I like the way this guy calls the game and watch their game?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes. Yes.
And do
Yes.
you.
And when you watch tape, you mainly watch your positioning. What you do is you kind of pause it, go, pause it, go, pause it, go. And then where the play happens, you see where you're standing and where you're looking. And that's how you improve your game.
That makes a lot of sense. That when you were talking and the players that you were naming, it sounds like you ref during the time of where it was more physical. Am I correct?
Yes. Yeah, most post play, yes.
Right. So there was a lot more that got away with. Do you see a lot of fights back in the era? And how did you guys decide to throw people out or not throw people out? Because it seemed like a lot of guys didn't get thrown out. You know what I mean? It seemed like it was just kind of like you got the tech and that was about it back then.
Yeah, it depends on the situation. Guys got thrown out if they were really throwing fists and connecting. But scuttlebutt and kind of like hugging and grabbing and would put, I mean, you would probably just give technical fouls. Don't forget, the fans came to see a pain to come see the stars play. So it had to be really, really obvious that they were disrupting the game to get them out of there.
Makes complete sense. Hey, we're gonna do a quick lightning round with you. Zach's gonna ask the questions. It's just like a one or two word answer to some questions that Zach has. Zach, are you ready?
I am. And my first question to you is, who is the toughest player that you had to guard as a player? Like, who's your toughest cover?
Probably Boo Rice out of Boston, Mass.
Okay. What's the most difficult environment that you've either had to play in or officiate in?
Small gym or a small playground with about maybe 500 people in the neighborhood, or a small gym, the final game, Probably New York City Pro-Am.
Okay. And what's the one thing as an official that just irritates the hell out of you? What's the one thing that just really gets under your skin while you're officiating a game?
The coaches refereeing plays that I already have blown the whistle for.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. Most pleasant or unpleasant player that you've ever officiated that comes to mind?
Michael Jordan.
Okay. What's the
Oh, you
wildest
know,
ex-
all right, let me change that. David Robinson.
Okay, interesting. The Admiral, I love it. What's the most wild experience that you have as an official? What's that one experience that comes to mind?
Oh yeah, wild when one of the players in New York City Summer League didn't like the call. He ran up to me and kicked me in my butt.
What's the best advice you ever received as an official, and why?
The best of advice I received.
Yeah.
Probably the story of Larry Brown. I'm
Sorry, go
sorry.
ahead.
There's another. When I was refereeing the Little League at the local Boys and Girls Club, an old timer came in to me and he said to me, "This is really serious stuff. You have to get into it." And I was a young referee. That was valuable to me too.
Absolutely. And my final question to you is, what's your favorite basketball memory? If you had to pick just one, what's that one that comes to mind?
Okay, so you ready for this story?
I'm ready.
So I'm refereeing in the NBA, my hometown Boston Celtics at Chicago. I think Michael Jordan from baseball. Okay, I think it's the second season. And I'm a trail referee, and Michael Jordan gets the ball, and now I'm trying to beat him down the floor to be the lead to referee the play. And the rule of thumb in refereeing is you don't watch the game. You're refereeing the game. You're in the game, Zach. You're not like a
Right.
spectator, because if you're a spectator, you miss calls, right? You watch. So this is my experience with the Michael Jordan play. I tell this all the time. He comes down to the baseline, and that whole rule of thumb has just gone out the window for me. I'm watching the game, and he stops on a diamond. So he like what do you call it? A thoroughbred. And he stops on a diamond in the corner and just rises up to take a jump shot. And I go right with him. I go, wow. And he knocked. And if he got fouled, Zach, I would miss that call all day long. And he went up and he just jumped like his legs went to my shoulders, and jump shot went in. And my whistle came out. I was like, wow. And then I just put my whistle back in my mouth and gathered, ran back up to court to the young kids all the time. That's a true story. That's a true story. That's my.
That's amazing to be able to have that experience. I mean, not many people get to. That's unbelievable. Want to thank you so much for your time. Before we let you go, let's plug True Bounce Backboard one more time, and why don't you give us a little elevator pitch to get people interested from our program.
Okay, so the True Bounce backboard is a premier backboard for basketball. It releases 28% of the ball's energy, similar to the breakaway rim, which is required to release 35 to 50% of the energy. Players are able to use the backboard with confidence, finish strong, rebounding techniques that come back into play, fundamental fast breaks. We've been in business for 20 years, and players absolutely love the feel of the True Bounce backboard. It's perforated, the depth perception is enhanced. We can bring back post players, and this will also balance out the three-point attempts, because once players in the mid-range stop making shots because of the better backboard, they'll have to be doubled down, and now we can kick for open three-pointers, and the whole balance of the game goes back to normal. It intensifies defensive coverage too, because now the players have an option. It's something that has never been thought out, because the basketball backboard, the glass backboard, Eric, was implemented for fans. It wasn't implemented for the game. We implemented the true bounce backboard for the game and the fans. It's rule compliant. It's just a better bounce, more fundamentals. And if we can help get it into the mainstream, we're trying to get experimental, that may be at Division III or even in the NBA Summer League to show the players how much more we can give them and how much more ability they can show the basketball world using the backboard.
That would be amazing, man. All the luck to you on that one. Before I let you go, Zach, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to say thanks for your time. This is an honor to have our first referee and, you know, coach to coach. I really appreciate what you're doing every day. But no, and a friend of Con Man is a friend of mine. So just thanks again for being on the show. And you're welcome back anytime, my man. Best of luck to you with True Bounce and all the other great stuff you have going.
Yeah, you guys do a wonderful job. Anytime, yeah, I love to talk basketball. I can give you some heads up on refereeing. And I'm really the only guy in the world that knows basketball and product and can help the game improve for a player standpoint. All right. Hey, this is great. I'm going to thank Con Man. He was right. He said, let me tell you something, Eric. I'm telling you, you're going to love these guys. And he was right. I don't want to tell him he was right, Zach, but I got to.
Hey, everyone's right every once in a while, you know, but we do appreciate the kind words a lot. We really appreciate that.
Absolutely. I got to call him now, tell him he was right. Just like I told that coach I missed the call. Well, I guess it's my two in a row this week.
Love it, man. Eric, thanks for coming on the show today, my friend. Be safe out there. Thanks again.
All right, Merry Christmas. God bless you guys. Thanks, man.
Take care. You know, it was really cool to interview our first ref. Eric was awesome giving us that information. There's a lot of things that we don't think. We're all armchair referees and we sit on our couches and can't believe refs miss calls and things like that. But, you know, the biggest thing we don't think about is how fast the game actually does move. And when it's in front of you, it moves a lot faster than it's on your TV. So I thought that was cool he brought up those things.
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, coaching like high school girls and everything, like it does move fast and you can't get every single call. And so I just appreciate the ones that can talk to you and explain to you, like, you know, what they saw or how they saw it or if they missed it. And so him being able to, you know, tell that coach and that player that he missed a call, you know, that means a lot to a coach and a player because everyone's competitive in the game. And that's really from my perspective, all I want is answers and somebody to talk to explain that to me. You know, I don't want to try to do their job. I'm not the type of coach that's going to try to referee the game for them. I just want, you know, that communication so that I can tell my players, like, hey, you know, you need to adjust. They're going to be calling it this way. So,
oh, totally. You know, and the one question I wanted to ask him and I forgot to was, you know, when you have different referees calling the game with you, like, do you know them and know their style so you know how to adjust right to like how they call the game, if that makes sense. I just forgot to ask him, unfortunately. But yeah, it was a cool conversation. It was really neat to just to get the inside of it. I think it's one of the things that I love about our show is we get to bring on a lot of different people involved with the game, you know, whether it's radio guys, you know, obviously players, overseas players, fans. There's just so many, I think, different aspects of the game that's important to learn. So it was very cool to get that insight today. And honest insight. That was the other thing that was great. It wasn't canned answers. It was actually honest insight, which I always appreciate. I always hate the canned answers, like, you know, when you see the end of the game and they're talking to the coaches and stuff. And it's just, oh, you know, oh, it's a process. We have to, you know, we have to move the ball, blah, 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 blah. Like, I hate that. Like, be real, like, you know, because you're going to learn more if you understand more, right? And I loved how he just, I mean, if you're a player listening to this right now, like, you know, and you got through all the way to the end, you know, I think you're going to learn a lot about how you approach the game as a player now after listening to this, because I don't think a lot of players understand what goes on in a ref's head. I mean, I know when I played football and other sports, it was, I politely asked the ref, like, hey, ref, can you watch the holding on this guy? This guy's holding me. Like, very politely, not like, you know, screaming at him or whatnot. And maybe he'd blow the whistle next time. Maybe he wouldn't. Who knows? But it was one of those things that it does make a difference if how you approach somebody. And just in life, how you approach somebody. If you're yelling and screaming at somebody, the person's not going to want to help you. You know, right. if you're going to be a Karen, they're not going to want to help you. So there you go. Speaking of that, we don't have any Karens, man. We got nothing but people showing love and sharing our stuff. And we've been away for a bit, but you guys are still sharing our stuff, which we really appreciate. And it does help us out, helps us get great guests, and helps us give you a better show. So thank you so much. We're still charting in a bunch of countries too, which is amazing. It's very, very cool. So we appreciate all that stuff. Is there anything you want to add before we get out of here?
Yeah, just big thanks to Mr. Eric Brito for taking the time to be with us. That's an honor. Big thanks to Conman for linking us up with him and getting him on the show.
Totally.
And shout out to all the good Karens, because not everyone named Karen is a bad person. So, you know, there's some good Karens out there. So shout out to the good ones.
Oh, my God. Wouldn't it suck if your name was Karen or Kyle right now in this world? Oh, my God. I would probably change my name.
Yeah, so I just want to say we're not singling out all the Karens.
No, and you know what? I blame all the managers from back in the day, where the customer was never wrong. That attitude, that's what got you the Karens, or the Karens in parentheses, right? Because that attitude that managers have, where the customer is never wrong, that should never happen, because yeah, there's plenty of customers that are wrong.
But I do know some lovely, nice ladies who are named Karen.
I do too. I do too. I went to school with some Karens, and they were actually good people. So much love to Karens, the good Karens, not the HOA Karens.
Right.
Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, be good to yourselves. Be good to others. Take care of yourselves out there. Have a Merry Christmas and all the good stuff, because I'm sure this will be out before Christmas. And peace.